5 minutes after 11 o'clock, 88 degrees here at the Paddock Mall. Thank you for tuning into The Source, WOCA. It is time to speak about our mental health, our addictions, our vices, the things we maybe do to ourselves, or maybe things have happened to us. And, we are a complicated animal, aren't we? We've got so many different things that are thrown our way, and we react to them a certain way. And so this chat is called Recovery Talk. Leslie Fairchild is our guest this morning. She is an LMHC, which stands for Licensed Mental Health?
Yes.
Counselor.
Mm-hmm.
Licensed Mental Health Counselor and a therapist with The Refuge, which is important to mention. The Refuge is PTSD and Trauma Treatment Center, as well as other kind of, what do you call them?
Addictions.
Addictions, thank mm-hmm. you for that. And rehab, I guess you would say. Now, it says here that we're going to talk about co-occurring disorders, so I have a little cheat sheet here from Robin Leslie, mm-hmm. so... Mm-hmm. So you just know that I know kind of what we want to talk about. I don't know what it is. So, well, first of all, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Are you
too.
From Ocala?
Yes, I am.
Oh, wow.
Well, actually, I was born in Puerto Rico, but
Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Wow.
But moved to Ocala when I was 4.
And do you speak Spanish?
No, not anymore.
Not anymore? Oh, when you were little, you did?
Yes, I did.
And you lost it, huh?
Yes, my parents said I didn't want to speak Spanish anymore, so they didn't keep it up.
Yo quiero Taco Bell?
No, not right now.
It's not a thing I know. And the Refuge, of course, is in Akawaha. So
yes.
You had it just seems such a like beautiful location.
It is.
For some place where people are trying to... Is it fair to say that we do these things to ourselves for the most part? I mean, not all. I mean, if somebody's been abused, obviously they didn't do that to mm-hmm. themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, in my experience with this population, it just seems it's not that so much that they're doing it to themselves. They don't know how else to handle life.
Ah.
A lot of the people we see at the Refuge, all of them, have some sort of trauma in their background. And, they're trying to figure out how to live their lives, and oftentimes that leads to some form of addiction, whether it's drugs or alcohol or eating disorder or a sex and love addiction.
Sex and love addiction.
Yes.
See, I could handle that one, I think. I don't know. That sounds like a good one. Now, I'm sorry. It probably was an inappropriate thing to say. But tell me about the co-occurring. I'm guessing that means two things at the same time?
Yes. It means that at least there's one mental health diagnosis and one substance abuse disorder going on at the same time, independent from each other. It doesn't mean that there's just one mental illness and one substance abuse. It used to be referred to as dual diagnosis, but that often confused people because it meant that there were two, but there could be, you know, so many more.
Oh, could be more.
Okay. Yeah, like okay. some of the yeah. clients at the Refuge have, like, let's say, alcohol use disorder,
right.
but they also have PTSD and major depressive disorder.
And what is PTSD?
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
Oh, PTSD. Okay.
PTSD.
And does the issue of mental health always coincide with the other addiction?
Yeah, usually it does. You know, sometimes the mental illness can begin on its own, and whether it's a genetic situation going on, you know, there's a predisposition for it, or let's say something situational that contributes to the depression, and then it becomes more clinical, like a major depressive disorder. And then the, you know, let's say alcohol's the substance of choice, it can come in because maybe it numbs their pain, maybe it helps them to sleep, maybe it makes them a little bit more animated because, you know, you drink, you know, a bit and you're not thinking about what you're depressed about mm-hmm. anymore.
Yeah, maybe. I'm guessing that in your line of work, and I'm not diminishing in any way a medical professional who handles like heart disease or something, but it's almost like cut and dried for them. Okay, you've got an artery that needs to be fixed. Let's fix it. Mm-hmm. In your work, I mean, it must take more time. You must have to spend mm-hmm. more time, you yes. yourself, with your mm-hmm. patients, clients. Am I
yes.
right about that?
Yes. You don't want to be too quick to make a diagnosis because, I mean, that goes on their record.
So how do you handle it? I mean, that sounds like you would get close to people,
mm-hmm.
whereas, and again, a dentist, a doctor, they don't mm-hmm. necessarily spend that much time with you, so they don't mm-hmm. get close to you. But you must get close to a lot of people.
Oh, yes.
Am I right?
Yeah, they're opening up about their pass their problems. They're trusting me. And, you know, that's the only way to really get better is to have trust in your therapist. That is the therapeutic alliance between the client and the therapist is the single most important factor in recovery for these people.
Wow. Am I right in assuming that you have to dig and then finally you see something other than what it looked like in the beginning?
Yeah. I mean, you have to ask the right questions.
Mm. And is it sometimes predictable? Like sometimes can you guess?
Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. Because you've seen it.
You've seen the experience, yes.
How do you get the people to trust you when you are their therapist and their person that guides them through this addiction? How do you get them to trust so they know that you're genuine and really want to help them?
Well, being me. just, you know, I can't really explain it. It's just it's personality thing. But also, I think one of the most important things in building the alliance is letting them know you're not judging them. You're coming from your heart.
Right.
I can't really explain beyond that. It amazes me how I can meet someone for the very first time in a session and I connect with them or they feel connected to me.
You know, a hospice talks sometimes about bereavement counseling and sometimes for children who've lost a loved one and they have sometimes camps, in fact, where they go to. So let's just jump from that a little bit. Would somebody in mourning who hasn't let go of it after a certain amount of time, it's always expected for a certain while, but if somebody who's still kind of hanging on to that probably would use something like alcohol or who knows what else. Have you seen this?
Yes.
Does this happen?
Yes. Oh, very much. You can, any life event can trigger, you know, use. I've heard some clients say, oh my gosh, I tasted, you know, that glass of wine was just, it took all my grief away. It took, it
really?
Just talk on, yeah.
So I went to a wine tasting and my favorite thing was the chilled ones.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take anything away though.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's not the case for all people.
Right,
it could
be
a hit of heroin. It could be shooting up on heroin.
That's pretty serious stuff.
Yeah.
Gosh.
If you want to call, we are taking phone calls. So feel free to call. Leslie Fairchild is our expert today from The Refuge. She is a licensed mental health counselor, a therapist with The Refuge. And we're talking about co-occurring disorders. So let's kind of do that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Give me two common ones. PTSD and alcohol sounds like it's
mm-hmm.
common, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm guessing the PTSD happens in war or?
It can happen just about anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It can come from a car accident. It could come from child abuse, physical abuse, sexual
Where
abuse.
They were the abused?
Yes.
Okay.
It could come, you know, it's when you feel like the threat of harm to yourself. And having a hard time struggling in the aftermath of that.
Wow.
A lot of times what we see with the clients that we see at The Refuge is something can happen, some kind of event can happen that can trigger their decline, their dysfunction. And when we are unraveling their story, we see that there's more, you know, that happened in their childhood that is contributing to, you know, why they may have turned to the alcohol. The other thing too is, you know, a lot of these people come from homes where alcohol and drugs were abused in the home.
Now, okay, I'm trying to imagine how you do what you do. If I were trying to understand why somebody was using alcohol and I was listening to their sob story mm-hmm. and I got sucked into it, not meant to be cold, but let's say I looked at it that way. And then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, it sounds like you're blaming everybody else for your problems. Mm-hmm. Do you then, at that point, go to those other people to try to see what the other side of the story is?
No. I mean, sometimes it helps the client, but that's not what you don't necessarily
you don't need to do that.
No. It's all about the perception at that time. The one example that just pops in my head is a coworker was talking about when he was two, he felt like he was attacked by a dog, and his mom was sitting there and, you know, didn't do anything. And when you hear the mom's side of the story, it wasn't a dog; it was a puppy licking him.
Oh.
So that's what we deal with. Sometimes we do go to the families and say, well, what's being described. And sometimes that can, you know.
So could you convince him that he just remembered it wrong?
Remembered it wrong. That's not really how we, you know, go about it. We go with their perception, and his perception was that he was in danger.
So then how do you take it from there?
Well, I mean, adding, you know, giving that perspective, that the mother's perspective of that, you know, the account helps him as well. And then for him, for example, he was, you know, scared of dogs for many years from what he tells. And, he actually married somebody that was a dog trainer. So you have that exposure therapy, I guess, that helped him. But still, you know, the trauma was, you know, ingrained in his head at two to be afraid of dogs.
Isn't that something? Wow.
How do you treat both symptoms at the same time, or do you treat one and then when they look like they're getting better for one, you treat the other?
Well, it depends on what we're seeing coming in, because someone that is high or drunk can appear psychotic. So we have to detox them to see where their baseline is at. But then also, you know, after they are detoxed, they can experience post-acute withdrawal syndrome, which can make it look a bit crazy as well. So, I mean, it takes some time to really accurately diagnose somebody. You know, with insurance companies, they want a diagnosis right here, right now. So have to, you know, go with what we see and what we, you know, what we observe, what they're telling us.
Right.
But, you know, it's been my experience that a lot of times with clients that have a substance abuse diagnosis and a mental illness, when you start, when you get them sober, when you start picking apart the layers, you see that there's trauma.
So what is addiction? How is a person who drinks wine not addicted and somebody else drinks wine and they are addicted? What is the difference?
There's
like you said,
DSM.
Sex and love before. I mean, that's part of life. At what point is it an addiction?
When a maladaptive pattern develops, you know, as far as, you know, coping with something, when it's all you can think about, when, like certainly with substances like alcohol and drugs, if you're experiencing withdrawal symptoms from using it, when you might be having problems socially, at work, even using, even like an alcoholic, for example, continuing to use even though the doctor has said, listen, you're diabetic, you shouldn't be drinking because it's going to exacerbate your, you know. Mm-hmm. When you wake up, I've heard some clients say, you know, I wake up and it's the first thing I want.
So what do you do? How do you stop that? Or I'm guessing if they're with you.
I don't stop anything. They stop it.
Okay, but if they're with you, they are there because they've A, admitted it, recognized it, and B, want to have help.
Mm-hmm.
You've got them on your side, sort of, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they want what you are able to deliver.
Yes.
Wow, so what do you do? How do you
tell? You explore their use. You know, a lot of things we do at the refuge is, you know, their use timeline. Like, when did they first start using? And, you know, when did it escalate to where they're at? You know, what kind of events have happened around their use?
So what's harder? The person's addicted to something that can be completely stopped, or somebody, if you're addicted to food, you can't be completely stopping. And the same thing with sex and love. I mean, you can't completely stop it. Mm-hmm. I guess you could with sex and love. But
it is hard. I mean, with the eating disorders and sex and love, it is very hard to treat because it's something that you confront every day.
Crank it down a little bit.
For somebody with bulimia, for example, they, you know, have to eat. I mean, that we have to eat to sustain ourselves. So it is a very difficult.
And bulimia is the one where they eat and they vomit?
Yeah, they binge and purge, yes.
Ay, ay, ay.
And sometimes a person thinks if you have sex that's love. So you have to also treat that. So it's so they're two different things.
Yes. Yeah. You know, a lot of the sex and love addicts, you know, you oftentimes see that there's, you know, a sexual trauma in their background. Mm-hmm. They struggle to know what a relationship, you know, looks like or feels like, and they will turn to sex and love.
When you say sex and love, can you separate the two? I mean, can you be addicted mm-hmm. to love?
Yes.
Who describe that person? What's that person going through?
That they have to be in, you know, forgive me, I'm not the expert, like as some of my
other... It's a Robert Palmer song, isn't it?
Yeah.
Might as well face it, I'm addicted to love.
Right.
Remember
right,
that?
Right. You know, I had a client that felt like, love was the answer. Like, if they didn't have love, if they didn't have that relationship, that they weren't anything. To the very core, it comes down to self-esteem.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So do you have to point that out to them?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, we don't go right into it and say, oh, you have a sex and love addiction, so, you know, let's look at your self-esteem. You unravel the story for them.
Do you know what I often think? And this is a little bit of a tangent, but if I see... like a woman who's working as a prostitute, I often think to myself, wait a minute, God gave you a talent. We saw the special on TV. It's what made me think of this. Well, there's these girls in Bangkok, and that's what they do for a living. Mm-hmm. And it's like accepted. But I felt like, well, could I speak to them just for a second? Because, look, I'm a man. I get that whole part. But look, I'm also a dad, and I've got a mom and a sister, and you know, mm-hmm. so why don't you've got God gave everybody a talent, so mm-hmm. can you maybe save that, you know, for this one guy?
Yeah.
And then there's a talent in there somewhere. Maybe you're a great writer or a great architect or something.
Mm-hmm.
And
a lot of these people don't see their talents.
That's again, the self-esteem part, isn't it?
Yes.
So they think all their worth is... They're a sex toy. They're a living, breathing sex toy.
Yeah, sometimes.
They are, and somebody else is convincing them that they're right.
Yeah.
Well, it's not that they're convincing them that they're right. It's that, you know, the trauma that they endured, you know, in their background, in their childhood, especially. You know, childhood, that's where we, you know, start figuring out who we are, mm-hmm. what, you know, where we fit into this world, where we develop our core beliefs about ourselves. And, you know, oftentimes you see with trauma survivors, they have very distorted beliefs about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, looking at that and picking that apart and getting them to form healthier.
I bet you they fall in love with you. Am I right?
What's that?
The guy has fallen in love with you. I mean,
with me?
Yeah. I mean, you're there all the time. You coming in, you're showing them love, you're caring about them.
You can't, that can happen.
Then what do you got to do? You get somebody else?
Called boundaries.
you tell them there's boundaries?
Yes, there's boundaries, and there's good therapeutic value to them developing, you know, those feelings towards a therapist.
Yeah.
So you work with that. Well, what is it about me that attracts you, you know, to me?
Do you help people that are bipolar?
Yes. Yes.
And how do you help someone like that?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the best treatment for bipolar disorder is medication. So teaching them.
Oh, really?
Yes. You know, medication compliance.
So that's, that's a chemical thing?
Yes.
Bipolar? Oh,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then teaching them, you know, routine and structure is very important for someone with bipolar.
Mm-hmm.
Sleeping, eating, exercise, you know, that. All those are the very basics in maintaining bipolar disorder.
You know, Leslie, I think ultimately these visits, while they're fun for us, I think there's always somebody out there who really will benefit from the information, who's wanting to know more.
Yes.
Is it possible, if I'm not putting you on a throwing you a curve or anything, can you give me a success story? Somebody you worked with who now you would never believe they were like that, but they're like this now. Can you? Any success stories with whether it's alcohol or something?
There was a few years ago, there was a woman that I worked with that was an alcoholic and a drug addict and bipolar, and she is bipolar. And she also had trauma in her background, and just working with her and picking it apart and getting her to see that she was not this, you know, wasted, you know, human being, that she had, you know, these dreams and aspirations and goals and talents. And by the time I finished with her, she was in college. She had finished her first year, and she was actually, you know, going towards a career in substance abuse.
Wow. Oh, wow.
A counselor. So, you know, that's one I like to think about. I don't know how she's doing today, but I like to think that
she saw her actually change for the better.
Yes, because, and the one thing she said that was very instrumental in her recovery is I didn't treat her as an addict. I saw her as a person.
I bet that is true. Yeah.
And I helped her to see why she was using drugs and alcohol.
Can I tell you one that we heard of? On Thursdays, we have a veterans program, and there was a couple in here. And he was a Korean War veteran. And in Korea, I guess they called it shell shocked at the time, but nowadays we call it post-traumatic stress disorder. She came in with him. The wife came with the man. The whole time they were married, she always knew something in that war changed him because she knew him before he went to war. So she stuck with him because she knew the real guy and she knew something. And she always heard about this, like, this is like within the last 5 years.
Yeah.
She learned about this thing called post-traumatic stress disorder. She was hearing about the guys coming back from Afghanistan.
Yes.
Long story short, she said she talked him into going. He said, I don't need a shrink. I don't need a psych, whatever. Anyway, he finally goes in. He's in the studio and the veteran show, and he is swearing up and down this is the best thing he ever did. And she is swearing up and down, he is the guy I knew before he went to war. Now, these people are upper 60s, maybe you would say?
Yeah, I would say that.
So their whole lives, this poor guy has had to deal with that. And finally, somebody with your skills was able to help him out of that.
Well, you know, what I have seen, you know, over my lifetime is... Mental illness, mental health, and substance abuse, it's been a very taboo subject.
Right.
A lot of people think, oh, if I know somebody or if I say that somebody in my family has a substance abuse addiction, then that means that our family's dysfunctional. If somebody is diagnosed with bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, or even depression, oh, that family's crazy. And so just there's more awareness out there. And people living, you know, with mental illness and recovery, you know, from substances are speaking out more and more. So unfortunately for that gentleman you were talking about, when he came back from the war, it wasn't talked about, wasn't addressed.
Right. And in fact, embarrassed probably.
Yes.
Can outsiders see something wrong with a person before a family member or a friend?
Yes. I think an outsider has an unbiased view versus a family member.
Maybe even more caring. I've seen so many people who were they just don't get, like, I can see, okay, that person's got a little issue, but you're being mean to him and stop it, knock it off, you know, I can see that somebody outside, and like Robin says, can not only see it, but maybe more compassionate.
Yes. Well, I mean, the family member, they have their ulterior motive at play there. It's not always a negative one. It could be, I really want my family member to get better, or why can't they just stop drinking? I don't understand it. Or with the depression, you know, if they're depressed, why are they drinking? They can just get up and go find a job that would be a whole lot better. And so you bring someone in, such as myself, and, you know, to pick apart the story and just to bring some education and awareness to the family. And you know, that helps. Not all the time though. Some families are very close-minded.
Leslie, I am always fascinated by what you and your profession do, because like I said, comparing it to a doctor, it's not that theirs is easy, but theirs is kind of cut and dried. Once it's diagnosed, there's an avenue. In your case, once it's diagnosed, there's an interstate. I mean, you really have to travel a long way with each of your clients /patients.
And they're very lucky to have you.
Thank you.
Because you're very personable and you genuinely care.
So what do we do? We've got like 40 seconds. Do you want to give a phone number to the Refuge?
The phone number, 352-288-3333.
And right in Akaloha, and sometimes or all the time, insurance helps out.
Is it insurance, for the most part, yes, helps out. There's clients there that if it weren't for the insurance, they would not be getting help.
I don't know what that was right there. All right, thank you. Thank you for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Today, and come back. All right, we'll take a little break. We'll be right back. This is The Source, WOCA Ocala.